This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
Liberty is a state of mind and an ideology that we hold in our hearts. Freedom is much different. No matter how liberated you feel, there are some times where you cannot break free. Often there are powers stronger than any one person can overcome. If a group of people were to come in your house and take control of everything that you hold dear, what would your response be? If the lives of your family were at stake, would you stand up and fight or go with the flow so that they may live another day? It is difficult to know until you're put in that situation. Guarding against the theft of freedom should be one of your primary goals. There are those that have fought and continue to fight to taste the same freedoms we all take for granted. Too many that came before us have not been so lucky to enjoy these gifts. I'm Kevin Donaldson, and unfortunately, Mike Falace has been replaced by Spam and Elvis, and welcome to the Suffering Podcast. If you're a fan of overcoming adversity and overcoming suffering, then we're for you, because that's what we do here, and that's the stories that we highlight. So do me a favor, hit that like button, subscribe to the channel, please comment, ring the bell to get notified of all of our new content, now you can join. Follow us on all social media so you can find out what we're up to. On this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we have a weary traveler who flew in this morning, somebody who I've really been interested in talking to, because this episode is going to be a little bit of a departure from what we normally do, and that's George Drost to talk about the suffering of freedom. George, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm excited to share my story.
Before we get into anything, let's give a big shout out to our marquee sponsor, and that's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody as cops, but we do trust Toyota of Hackensack. So go to toyotahackensack.com. Let them find you a car. They know what they're doing over there. So, George, each week we take a question from our audience. This week's question comes from Coop357. How far would you go to defend freedom?
To the death.
To the death. There's a couple little caveats to freedom. Like, freedom is somewhat of an illusion, because total freedom will breed anarchy. I can't walk down the street and punch anybody in the face that I want to. We're all governed by, say, a Judeo-Christian moral or ethic. So I'm going to give you a scenario. And I spoke about this in my opening. Somebody breaks into your house and holds your family hostage and says, if you do not comply, I'm going to take away your freedom. And if you do not comply, something bad happens to your family. But if you comply, they are allowed to live. So what do you think about that? Like, is that still to the death?
Yeah, it is. And I think you're going in a direction I would have gone. And that is, what's the shading? What's the relative freedoms that you are defending? And what would you defend to the death? And so, there's a question, you know, do they take away my driver's license? Do I go and pretend to scream and yell and claim that I'll go to the death to save my driver's license? Or is it my life, my ability to make choices and to lead a life that we've been comfortable in enjoying here in the United States? Western style democracies basically is the route that I would go. And how much restriction do you put on yourself before you can't take it any longer, and that you have to do something to change the course of that, those actions that are restricting your freedoms?
Because there's many different routes you can take. You have like a Ruby Ridge type of situation where the guy just did not like what the government was doing, wanted to go off the grid, and ended up in a gun battle where people got killed. You know, who's right, who's wrong, it's not my place to sit here and talk about. But he was technically fighting for his freedom. So for me, I read a book years ago by a guy named Eric Fromm. And I never forgot the name because I went to school with a guy named Eric Fromm. And he wrote this book called Escape from Freedom. And what he basically says is, although you have the illusion of choice, you really don't. So if you have... here's a simple test for you. Go into a restaurant with a menu that's 10 pages long, and you're married. I believe you're married.
Yes, I am.
All right, so you're married. Imagine going into your wife to a restaurant with a menu of 10 pages long. Good luck eating in the next 40 minutes. You follow me?
Yep.
you want a purple car. You're not getting a purple car from the manufacturer. You're given six choices, and they limit them to six. And there's studies out there to show how many choices before people become overwhelmed and paralyzed by analysis. So as much as we think we have all these great freedoms, and in the United States, we do. We have to protect what we have because there are certain very important freedoms. So my question is I defend moral freedoms, things that I find, again, getting back to that Judeo-Christian morality. You know, I don't have the freedom to kill somebody. I don't have the freedom to steal from somebody. I don't have the freedom to go punch somebody in the face. My freedoms are for me and me alone until they affect others around me. You know, for instance, I can't light a 50-foot bonfire in the back of my house. I don't have that freedom because there's dangers to those around me. So I will protect my personal freedom until the death, like you said. But at the point where it's only affecting me and not affecting anybody else. So that's my answer to that.
Right. And I totally follow that where you it's going to Jeremy Bentham and you know, or John Stuart Mill, you know, those are other philosophers that basically looked at pragmatism and you have freedom as long as you don't oppress minorities and take away some of their freedoms. So it's really the relativity of it. And you don't have to have, let's say, freedom to avoid paying to the mosquito abatement district in your locality. You know, is that something that you'd fight to the death? But you go to the core pieces of if I can't do it or if I'm restricted in such a way that it does affect the way that I have been brought up and that the way that the norms that we have that allow you to make choices and not restrict you and have ease of entry into the marketplace, for instance, for entrepreneurial purposes, or going to a church or not going to a church. Those are important aspects to just day-to-day living. And those are the things I'm talking about, the bigger items. I don't care about a purple Tesla or a purple Toyota. Or right. It's the ability, if it's out there, I can say yes, I can say no, and that there won't be a restriction. But I don't want to affect other people in a meaningful way. And I've had some experience in our local community serving on the plan commission. And usually the projects that we see involve some changes that will affect neighbors. And you're going to build a 7 or 8 story apartment building and the people next door don't want to change because it's going to affect the way that they walk their dog.
Their taxes, their school system, on down the line.
But the density, the scaling, there's a whole series of issues, sights, smells, sounds, those kinds of things. And what you have to do is you have to create that balance. And the end result is that there has to be some sort of ultimate harmony. It's never 100%. Boy, that developer's got a great idea. 7 stories, there'll be a restaurant down there, there'll be swimming pool, there'll be dog parks. Let's buy into it where the other side, the neighbors who are going to see their tranquil little neighborhood change with the addition of smells and sounds and just the congestion that goes with it.
There's also the wolves that are looking out to capitalize on those people wanting true freedom.
Yeah.
Prime example of that is something that you lived through, and it's an interest to me, is the hippie communes of the 60s. All right. They were great in some things, but do you see any hippie communes laying around now? Because inevitably somebody went in there and said, oh, these people, they want freedom and love. Well, I might have a little unethical or nefarious purpose behind me, and I'm going to capitalize on their wants and desires. And then they come up and then you have like a Jonestown type of thing. So it's a weird thing to try to wrap your head around. But yes, for my personal freedoms, I'm with you.
Yeah,
I'll fight to the death.
It was expressed to me in one way about liberty and libertine, that liberty comes with responsibility, and libertine attitudes or conduct does not. So there's not only just having freedom, but that freedom is a responsibility, and that when you gain liberty, you need to be able to create the constructs to preserve it in a way that benefits most of society. You can't do it for all, but most of society. And being an attorney, there's such a strong emphasis on rule of law. And the rule of law is really sort of the composite of corporate thinking, corporate in the sense of people in the community, and to come up with solutions and ways to live with one another, kind to one another.
It's a great question. I think we could go on for hours on this one.
Yeah, we can.
So Coop, 357, thank you for sending that in. Keep sending in your questions, and we will try to get them on the air. We love thought-provoking questions like this. So you came from one cold city to another cold city.
Actually, this is a colder city than the city I left, because our temperature and weather basically is behind us, and you're going to get warmed up.
Yeah, so we're talking about Chicago, or the Chicago area.
Chicago area.
It's an interesting city. We talked a little bit about the history. By the time this airs, you and I will both have come back from CreativeCon, and I'll get to experience a little bit of it. There are some key sites, because I'm a history guy, which is why your story resonates so deeply with me. There's some pieces of history in there that I really, really want to go see. I want to see where Al Capone hid the vaults from Geraldo Rivera. That's exactly what I want to go see.
Good luck. Good luck.
So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Yeah.
Don't leave out your daughter, because she's our mutual connection.
Yeah. Well, I have to thank my daughter, Julie Loken. She basically connected Kevin and myself up for this podcast. And part of it is Julie's interest in podcasting and media, and I call it sort of the communication business. And it works on different levels. But Julie, thank you. And now we'll work a little bit backwards, because I came to this country in 1950. And I can't do the math, because I'm too old to do math.
74.
And depending on when you strike the anniversary date. But we came from the Czech lands. It was called Czechoslovakia when I left it. And it was due to a loss of freedom. We'll keep that theme going here. In 1948, in February, there was a communist coup d'etat. Some people call it a putsch. It was my dad, who was an attorney, who was basically threatened with loss of not only his profession, his freedom, but his life.
But there was also a Sophie's Choice going on in there.
It was.
And I know some backstory to this. So how many siblings do you have?
One.
You have one. So two of you, your father, your mother. Older?
And my brother, Rudy.
Your brother?
Older brother.
Older brother. And not all could go.
No, not all could go. But it was a complication, because I was too young. And basically, if traveling at a young age and blowing cover by screaming or yelling or crying as a one-year-old wasn't very good in 1948.
You had to go undercover and sneak out.
I was smuggled out.
You were smuggled out.
And I don't remember it, but... from the stories, it took a lot of courage on the part of a lady that that basically impersonated my mother, and she was she did a great job. She was able to do that. And my grandmother, who also was part of this smuggling arrangement, and we basically got out because we lied, we misrepresented ourselves. And maybe even bribed some.
It's amazing what you'll do for a taste of freedom.
And it was then connecting up, getting through what was a little bit pre-Iron Curtain, but it was still starting to come up and became very restrictive, where you couldn't come in and go.
This story affected me. One of my favorite teachers when I was a kid. kindergarten. So we're going back 45 years. His name was Oleg Gorbachev. That's how much this guy affected me that I'm able to remember that Russian name. Him and his wife were Russian Jews, and they had to get out of the Soviet Union because at the time the Soviet Union was not very Jewish friendly. And so they actually went out via Japan, but I remember as a little kid, him telling how he had to hide in a garbage can to get out of Russia, to be smuggled out of Russia. I think his wife wrote a book some years later, but what a great man and what a great giver to children that he was, that he affected me that much. And that story stuck with me for 45 years. I mean, how many stories do you remember from when you were 5 years old?
Not many.
Yeah.
And as I get older, I don't remember much anymore. So, but it was a struggle for me to kind of go back into my 3-year-oldness and try to remember what things could you remember? What did you remember? And I do remember, we had a housekeeper, lived with my grandmother, and I was basically shuffled between grandmothers so that I wouldn't be put on any record or roll in a census, so I could still maintain anonymity. It was that kind of cunning that helped the escape.
Well, this is how bad, I want to paint this picture. This is how bad it is where people will risk a 3-year-old's life in order to get them out of a very bad situation or a potentially bad situation. I want everybody to think about that for a minute, because take your current life right now. First of all, stuff like what you went through could never happen today within the digital era. You could never be anonymous. There are no people off the grid. There is a digital footprint for every person on the planet right now. So back then, they had to hide you, smuggle you, pretty much keep you quiet. And there's a little taste of this if you look at the in Godfather 2 when Vito Andolini has to get out of Corleone. Same thing. You know, you get caught. The consequences of this person taking you out of that country illegally, imprisonment. You're in a communist country, so.
Oh, yeah. There was an interesting story. I was involved in my legal career and still am involved in this, is in legal exchanges between the United States and the Czech and Slovak republics. And in one of our programs, we went to, we'd go back to Brno, where I was born, and then have certain activities. And one was going to prison near Brno. And just talking to some of the officials there, we met with individuals who ran that prison, and they gave us sort of an overlay of what occurred there. And they talked about the criminals that they had. Many of them had mental problems, and you had thefts and burglaries and assaults, and sometimes even a murder. And then I asked this prison official, what about political prisoners? You know, do you have any history of that? And they just went dumb. They didn't remember. They had no corporate memory of what it was like during the communist times. And this was the Sela prison in Brno. And this was the price my grandmother paid after they found out she was complicit in my being smuggled out of the Czech lands.
She was imprisoned?
She was in prison for 2 years.
Wow.
And it was rethinking, re-education.
You got to remember, too, that while the Czech Republic had the coup and was now communist, we all know who the real leader at that time of the Communist Party was. And we're talking about one of the biggest despotic rulers of all time, and that's Joseph Stalin in Russia. And it was Stalin died in 53 or 55 or
53,
something?
53. Yeah. And I just learned, and you can check this out, that the first U.S. person that was informed about Stalin's death was Johnny Cash.
Really? That's a great trivia question right there.
There's some controversy to it, but it's gained a little bit of currency. But he was a decoder in the military, and he was able to get these codes that were coming out of the out of Russia. And after they were decoded, Joseph Stalin is dead. Well, I believe it was 1953.
So you have to really think about how dangerous Joseph Stalin was. Joseph Stalin, when he died in 1953, let's use that for devil's advocate. He was placed right next to Vladimir Lenin in his preserved state, same way Lenin was preserved. And I don't know exactly the time frame of how long he was there, where people could visit in Red Square and stuff. And then something happened where he was taken out of there and buried under 50 trucks of concrete because he had killed. They don't know the number. They think upwards of 25 million people in the gulags. So you went to prison in a communist country. It's a dangerous situation. It's not like you got a possibility of parole, even though they might say it. It's touch and go there for a while.
Yeah, due process and rule of law wasn't really used a lot in the communist legal system. It was more expediency.
You know how many people these days, because communism is all but eradicated. You got Cuba, you got China. The basic philosophy behind communism is from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs, as Karl Marx wrote. But it's inevitably in all those communist countries, you have your elites and then you have your peasants. Mm-hmm. You know, it becomes a caste system of sorts like that. But in where you were, in Czechoslovakia, you left one bad, bad person, and then you got taken over by another bad, bad person. Czechoslovakia has had a past of just terror that has run through it. And that's kind of why we're here today, to talk about your father, who was kind of like this very silent hero, this person who did a lot behind the scenes because of whatever moral code he had in his heart. And one of the things people got to understand also is whether, and we're talking about Nazi Germany, who took over Czechoslovakia. Not everybody who was there bought into party politics. You know, just because you were a German in the 1930s and 40s doesn't mean you agreed with Adolf Hitler. Just because you were a Russian in Moscow during communist era doesn't mean that you believed in communism. I had a buddy that went over there and traded a pair of blue jeans. This is in the 80s. Traded a pair of blue jeans for a Russian military jacket. I saw it. I wore it. It's a little small for me. It was the most beautiful jacket I've ever seen in my life. And I said, "You got this for blue jeans?" And he goes, "I got this and a whole lot more for blue jeans." So just to give you an idea of the different freedoms and lack of freedoms they have, where they could be given this military jacket over and over again, but they can't get a pair of blue jeans.
Yeah, and that really goes to that to market market economics. And what China's been doing is that they've been allowing market forces to and market economies to thrive, but under the control of the Communist Party. They figured it out. They can fund their political missions through their market system economies, or close to market economy economic systems. The Russians didn't get it. Russians never really had the skill. The Chinese might, and I'm not trying to profile any ethnic group, but the Chinese always seemed to be a little bit more entrepreneurial. Zhou Enlai was one of those guys underneath the Mao Zedong government that understood that you really had to have qualified people to build your industries.
Well, they saw Russia failing.
Yeah. Russia was a good example of not what not to follow and to figure it out. You see this occurring in Vietnam.
And now there's so many people in China, it's like 1.5 billion people. So just the rule of attrition, they can do whatever they want to do. They'll have the best athletes because they have the biggest pool. They'll have the most economic pool because they have all the intellect. And that's what's, it's becoming almost a monopoly. And China, I just heard this statistic the other day, China there's a place in China called America. All right. Yeah. And they make a lot of goods there. And on the back, it's stamped Made in America. Hmm. Think about that. You want to talk about, if you can separate yourself from the improperness of that, it's really a brilliant marketing move. And, yeah. And they're brilliant people. They really are. It's just, there's too many of them there.
And well, that's drinking. That's they're one child and only a male child policy is basically having the chickens come home to roost now. And the population's declining. They've had some serious problems with their real estate and
famines.
Famines, but basically sort of integral pieces where they tried to control things and they didn't let market or natural instincts, impulses really govern what should have been. They tried to control it. And this is now coming back to bite them. And you still have about half of the population that is still rural. Half of it has really advanced a lot. And to the credit of the Chinese, they're very patient. You know, they persevere.
So trying to control your population sounds a lot like another form of government that happened in the 30s and 40s.
It did. And they didn't have digital ways to control you. They didn't have cameras on every corner. They didn't have the biometrics, the digital tools to really assimilate all this and get the data and the analytics that you need to create the control.
One thing I will say, and we're talking about Nazi Germany because it plays into the story of your father very deeply. Again, if we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. So I've become a student of World War II, German government at the time, and I look at how they do things. So one of the, and I know we don't talk about politics on the show, but I am going to say one thing political. While I myself abhor guns, okay, because of what I went through. I believe in people's right to carry a gun. Why do I do that? Because the first thing in 1933, when Adolf Hitler took over, when he basically, he just took it. First thing he did with the citizens is he took away the weapons because now the citizens don't have a chance to defend themselves. That's one of the reasons why the Second Amendment is in the Constitution. It's defense against tyrannical governments, not to shoot each other. And so I look at that. And that's a freedom that we have. So I'm hoping that when did your father pass?
He died in 2002.
He died in 2002. Were you able to sit down with him, other than what you read in his memoirs, were you able to sit down with him and have a man-to-man talk about some of his experiences during the Second World War?
Yeah, and that started to occur later in his life. And what was sort of the instigation of this all was that as we grew older, we wanted to really capture some of that family history. We were embarrassed by it.
Well, like you said, when you were young and World War II wasn't that far removed,
no, it wasn't.
It's too close to even talk about it. You know, I've said this a couple times on this show. When someone dies, a library burns to the ground. Things like shows like this, things like this book, while some of it is lost to history, not all of it's lost to history anymore. That's the beautiful part about the age that we live in.
No, and we can capture some of it. But basically, I'm not going to say I forced my dad to do it, but it's strongly suggested that he take down some of these memories. And then I found a writer for him. And that's when he started his memoir. And that was probably in the mid-90s. Or early 90s, and it took a long time. It was excruciatingly slow.
He's a 70-something, 80-year-old man at the time.
80. He was 92 when he died, yeah. So you can do the math backwards. Sure. So he was 80, maybe.
So he was born in 1920?
And his memory was good. He was still
10.
Sharp.
10? 1909.
1909. So the idea was to start to put all of this information down, what you could remember. And that's where Julie... last year, about a year and a half ago, she said, let's re-look at this.
Takes a long time to write a book. I'll be the first to admit that.
And let's try to contemporize it. Don't make it into a history book. Make it into a story. And so that's, you know, what was the genesis for that.
So let's go back. When did the Germans invade Czechoslovakia?
1938. That's when they took it over. It became the protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, and Slovakia became independent.
Well, if I remember correctly, they just walked in.
They did.
Yeah, they did. Didn't. There was really no fighting.
No, that was the Munich Agreement. That was Neville Chamberlain. You know, you go back to peace in our time.
Appeasement.
Appeasement, yeah. Peace in our time. And that was the door opener for Hitler. And Hitler was, previous to that time, he was doing his land grabbing all around Germany to restore the Third Reich, the empire, you know, the glory of the old Reich, and the legends and the stories, the Wagnerian stuff, you know, everything kind of coalesced there. But it was the Ruhr, it was the Saar Valley, it was encroachments into in support of fascists like in Spain, and then the combination of Hitler and Mussolini, and trying to strengthen those ties of countries that were fascist. And then you had your monarchists in Japan, which were developing an authoritarian type of government as well.
Do you recall his words when Germany first came in? Do you remember, did he say what the feeling was? Was it an ominous feeling? Was it a feeling of joy? Because you got to remember, Germany is a rising power in the world in 1938. Since 1933, they're going up. I think 1933, Hitler was Time Man of the Year. Henry Ford was over there. Charles Lindbergh was over there. There's pictures of them meeting this at the time great leader of the world who's bringing Germany out of the ashes after the Treaty of Versailles that crushed Germany. So there's all these things going on. And I often wonder that when he comes in, is he seen as a tyrant or is he seen as a savior?
Well, it depends on your constituency, because the Czech lands had a very strong German influence. So there were Germans that cheered on Hitler. They thought this was manifest destiny for the German people. And if you can put it into sort of an analogous light, one good example is the Sound of Music and the Von Trapp family, where was everybody against Hitler and the Anschluss of combining Austria to the German Reich? Probably, you know, not. There was probably a lot of happy people there. There was a lot of...
if I had blonde hair and blue eyes, I'd be thrilled to death.
Well, it was that Bavarian connection, the strength of the Bavarian stock to the Austrians. And Hitler, don't forget, was born in Austria.
Yes, he was.
And he lived across the river, close in Passau. So he was sort of a southern German, a southern Deutsch. And there was always a tension in the Habsburg Empire as well, because Habsburgs were German-speaking, and they wanted to promote a German-speaking nation in the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
I just want to warn everybody, I finally met somebody who's just as big as a history nerd as I am. I love this stuff. I really do love this stuff on how it happened. Germany comes into Czechoslovakia. What is your father's first recollection of them?
First recollection is, get on your uniform. Let's go. We've got the support. We've got an alliance with France. France will come and defend us. We have...
Was it De Gaulle?
No, it was, I can't remember right now. Yeah. It could have been,
I'm thinking
it was the Vichy government. It goes back to
I'm thinking
the
of
old
Spain
general
with, Lissimo Franco.
Franco was the dictator there, but France was sort of bifurcated as well, because there were sort of, we don't want to go through another world war because we lost so many people in the First World War.
Right.
We paid a big price. If you've been to Verdun, you know.
The trenches are still there.
And the trees are yellow still from all of the lead that was used in the battle there.
There's a fascinating picture. I go through this site called archaeological.org, and there's a fascinating site. So to this day, 2024, they're building roads in France. and they come across this time capsule. What had happened is a German bomb blew up next to a trench from World War One, and it completely covered the trench with all the occupants inside. They get the archaeologists out there. They start excavating it. They found guns, helmets, newspaper, of course, the soldiers who were there, all perfectly preserved. Well, not perfectly preserved. They're in the ground, but preserved just a moment of time. Literally, the bones, somebody was holding a cup. I mean,
in time.
It's a little spooky when you think about it. War from a distance seems great, honorable. War in close up and personal, and we've had a lot of vets in here, including one from D-Day. War up close is horrific. It's traumatic. It is ugly. And it is survival mode all day long.
Yeah, well, you look in the book, and that's really a point that was that we tried to make in it. And Nikki did a great job of
Nikki Pasquarello, sure.
Yeah, she did a great job. And it was take us into the pre-World War One, sort of that bucolic, happy time. You know, people were comfortable. The pool in the community that we lived in Brno, that was more of a Viennese feel than there would be one to Prague. And there was an overlay of Germans that was there. Brno had maybe over a third were German-speaking, and there was a strong influence there, especially when you look at the economics of it. And then you go into World War One, and one of the things I never really understood is my grandfather fought for the Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm, and he's born in Prague, was born to and became a German citizen. So he would be drafted by the Kaiser Wilhelm, not Kaiser Franz Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to war, but he didn't like war. He was sort of I got to go. Maybe, you know, the old joke about, you know, your horse has diabetes. He was trying to find ways to get himself out of that duty. But we had a neighbor, according to my dad's memoir, Marek, who thought this was really great. And if you've seen the old movie of All Quiet on the Western Front, that original movie in the 30s, where all the schoolboys, they would just say to war, you know, throw up their papers and they strut out. And then, you know, obviously the story goes on and how bad the war is and how it affects all the individuals.
The best picture I've ever seen of the result of war is somewhere, I think it's in France. There's a bicycle. Guy rides his bicycle to the draft office, parks his bike by a tree, goes to war, never comes home. That bicycle to this day is encapsulated in that tree. The tree just grew around the bike, so the bike looks like it's sitting in the tree. And
wow.
If you look at that piece of history and you think, this is a man who rode this bike here 100 years ago, 110 years ago, and never came back to reclaim the bike. That is war.
That is. And, you know, moving on, when they came back from war, there was this period of quiet and tranquility. And then back to your point, in the 30s, when there was this anti-Semitism that was starting to develop, that affected our family. And I want to get that piece of the story into it as well, because my grandmother was Jewish.
So that's one of the things that fascinates me about Nazi Germany is, why do you hate Jewish people so bad? Like, what did they do? And Hitler, so there was a cool story about that I just heard about Hitler. Did you ever see the movie Cabaret?
Yeah. Several times.
So one of the things Hitler did was he closed down all the cabarets because he had to dehumanize Jewish people. For whatever reason, I don't know his reason. I haven't spoken to him. He's been dead for a long time. But for whatever reason, he really hated the Jews. So the cabarets and the actors and the dancers and all these cabarets were Jewish, most of them. Now, you can't hate somebody that you're going to go see and it's entertaining you, making you laugh, making you feel joyous when you're out. So he closes all the cabarets. And now all of a sudden, these Jewish people, they got to walk around with stars. It's crazy. It's really crazy. What was the Jewish population in Czechoslovakia at the time?
Probably not too much, maybe 200,000. That would be I'm thinking as a population of Czechoslovakia, that's a combination of the Slovak Republic now and Czechoslovakia, maybe 200,000 out of 8 or 9 million people. But the interesting point is, and I've thought about this quite a bit, is why, to your question, why are Jews hated? You know, why Hitler picked on the Jews and fomented this anti-Semitism? Sort of the theory I've got is that was brought about by these people who were anti-Semites because they forced the Jews to be successful. They didn't allow them to own property. They limited their ability to participate fully in the economy, in the traditional economy, and they found ways to get into other businesses that nobody else wanted. And guess what? They became successful. And all of a sudden, we're mad at them because we kicked them out and they showed us that they could earn livings and prosper in ways that we didn't even think of.
Bring it to modern day. I'm going to bring this to modern day. Again, learning from history. Everybody coming back from World War II, the fathers went to work. They did construction. They did mason work. Italians did brick work. And then you start them. They never wanted their kids to do what they did, right? Mm-hmm. So they sent them off to college. Now you have this flow of college kids who are making peanuts, tons of student loans. Guess who's making the most money? Your masons, your construction workers. They get paid, if you go to, so Mike Rowe has the Mike Rowe Foundation. If you go to a trade school, they pay you half pay and you come out and you got a job waiting for you at $75,000 a year. I challenge a college student, the vast majority of college students, I challenge them to get out of college and make $75,000 a year.
We call them the two percenters. You know, we realize that. And we've been showing, and, you know, part of my efforts locally is to promote junior colleges. And you don't have to be a lawyer or a doctor or Carl Icahn, for instance, you know, our corporate takeover genius. His joke is that my parents wanted me to go to medical school, but I wasn't smart enough. So I had to become a lawyer and then a businessman. So
yeah, but so that's my era. Everybody was going to law school. So the 50-year-olds out there, when you were in college, there was this big rush to go into law. And then what happened? Everybody went into law and people are coming out and they're making $60,000, $50,000 with tons of student loans coming in because the job market was flooded. I don't know whether it's still that way and I don't have my finger on that pulse, but that's what happened. So learning from history where the Jews were taking jobs that nobody wanted and finding a way, because there's this equilibrium of life, finding a way to make them successful. And God, you're taking a job nobody wants and you're successful at it and you're making a living at it. And well, oh, I hate you now. It's so foreign to me.
And you've seen that in the book and the production of Ragtime, mm-hmm. where you've got the Jewish, actor there who develops motion pictures or, products in motion pictures. And that was, as the, movie business started to develop, it was relatively easy to enter it. Can't do it now because of the production costs that you have, but it was easy to buy a camera, roll some film, dress up a couple of actors, and then sell it to the Goy community, you know, which would go and watch it for entertainment. And they didn't realize they were enriching these people that, you know, didn't have access to the traditional trade unions or to the schools. You know, there were bars on entering into prestigious schools. And then finally, you know, that started to melt down and there was more or less equality in education to all people, all races.
The even the word Juden to this day holds weight. I was just watching this interview with Paul McCartney when he wrote the song, Hey Jude. He was in a store and it was posted up there, Hey Jude, whatever storefront that he had at the time. And somebody comes by and says, hey, you can't put that in there. That's a bad word. Like he didn't understand. It was about a person, But even back then in the late 60s, he still had a problem with the name Jude 20 years post-war. But the so the Jews really got put through hell. And I often wonder the people back then seeing that these Jews, some people with humanity who really saw them as people and not as the, as rats. And one of the best scenes to quantify how the people saw Jewish people, if you ever watched the opening scene to Inglourious Basterds.
Yes. You? Yeah.
So that is a beautiful, very eloquent way of why the Germans hated the Jews. To give everybody a synopsis, Hans Landa comes in and he talks about the difference between if a rat comes in your house, you try to kill it. If a squirrel comes in your house, you shoo it off with a broom. Well, a squirrel is a rat with a furry tail. That's all a squirrel is. Why do we hate this? Why do we hate the rat and not the squirrel? We don't know. We just do. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. So in your father's community, how many Jewish people were there?
Well, that was
aside from your grandmother.
Well, my grandmother, there were the grandmother's family. And give you the story is that my grandmother, before she married my grandfather, Otto, she converted to Protestant. She became a Lutheran. And in Brno, they have this red brick church. And at that time, it was called the Kaiser's Church. It was the evangelical Lutheran church. And so she basically converted or added to, you don't necessarily have to renounce one part, but she became a Christian. And so when my dad was born, he was baptized as a Christian and had the Christian upbringing.
And probably never heard about it again after the Nazis came in, like, no, I don't know about
it. Well, it was hard to ignore that when you had Uncle Oswald around or, you know, some of the other relatives.
But Roswald Rabinowitz, yeah.
Yeah, so they were Deutsch. That was
Deutsch,
the Deutsch,
okay.
Deutsch. Yeah. So the Deutsch family was there in different form or fashion. And there was a recognition. And my dad had picked up some Yiddish oy veys and, you know.
Meshuggah, Spilkes.
Yeah, Spilkes, Spilke.
Old Yiddish woman used to live down the street from me, so I'm well-versed in Yiddish.
Yeah, so you get that. And it wasn't, it was more endearing than it was kind of calling out or trying to distinguish. But there was the idea of the Czechoslovakia that was developed by Thomas Garrigue Masaryk. His philosophy: he married an American, took the American wife's last name as his middle name. He tried to embody Western style democracy and tolerance and he tried to find different ways to make it work within this complex ecosystem of different nationalities, ethnic groups, and religious groups, and socioeconomic groups. And the idea was, let's all be friends. We'll figure it out. We have the wealth, things that were left over by the Habsburgs, you know, the manufacturing facilities, and we've got the technical skills. We can become just like Great Britain. And to a certain extent, the Czech lands were really starting to advance economically. And Masaryk died in, died in 38, I think it was. But his tenure was over in 1935. And so he was sort of a calming influence over the nation. But then when his successor, who was also a pretty smart guy, but didn't have the charisma that he had, Edvard Beneš, took over, people started undermining him. And Beneš wanted to continue the message of Masaryk. Let's be friends. Let's be tolerant. You know, we don't want to pick fights for fight's sake, but we want to defend our country. And Masaryk was a friend of Jane Addams, which was also kind of unique when he taught at University of Chicago. And Adams chided him, said, you know, you're supporting militarization of your people to fight in World War I. And he said, absolutely. I'm a pacifist so long as it doesn't take away my freedom. I want to defend freedom. And he had an opportunity to create a nation by mobilizing and militarizing the offshore Czech nation of Slovaks and Czechs.
I think he wanted to be that gardener, it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. It's okay to be a pacifist. Nobody should like war. But there are times when you need to step up and you need to say enough's enough, and war is almost inevitable. And in this case, it was. But your father did something very interesting to try to save his moral code and make himself right with his God in order to try to help out these poor people.
Exactly. And what it was is the way he was brought up. And that was part of what Nicky's story is about, it, the kind of associations he had as a kid with his friends and how they had these different ideas, but they all hung together. Well, they'd make fun of somebody from time to time, but there was a sense of sympathy, empathy within them, and also outrage, too, when the family dog was shot by a warden, a forest ranger, basically. And that got my dad's anger up, and he saw that through that dog story, and then about people being treated like dogs.
Yeah. When you've witnessed firsthand man's inhumanity to man, and I'm including women in this, I'm not trying to be gender specific, but when you've witnessed man's inhumanity to man, it really turns a switch into somebody who has a soul. To me, those upper people in the German government, they were soulless. I know they had their reasoning for doing what they're doing, but they have no soul, because if you've ever had to look in somebody's eyes, they're not the ones going out and treating these people like dogs. They're having their underlings go out and treat them like dogs. You know, you go to someplace like the Holocaust Museum. I've been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C., and you see the room with all the shoes, and you look at it, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is awful. This is absolutely awful. And I don't understand why anybody would think that way about anybody. You know, I know, let me be quite honest, I know assholes that are Jewish. I know assholes that are Christian. I know assholes that are Muslim. But I also know great people who are Jewish, Christian, Muslim. I know great, some of my best friends in the world are those religions, are different colors. You know, ice cream is good. Rum raisin is good. Chocolate is good. Vanilla is good. It's all good. You know, it's just different flavors, you know, and that's kind of what makes the freedoms that we enjoy, that we have that choice. But these people, they had their freedom taken away. I'm digressing a little bit. Yeah. Your father did something very special for these people that he felt some sort of humanity for. Mm-hmm. Why don't you explain what he did?
Well, he lied in a lot of ways. He was deceptive. He was manipulative. But again, it puts you in this cast as, what is your moral compass? How were you brought up? And are you going to follow rules? Because the rules lead to the death of an individual or the confiscation of their property. So what you have to do is you have to look at this as, put your be a thinker and think. That's also another little line that Nicky throws in there. Think. Figure it out. Take the big problem and break it into little problems.
Don't let anybody think for you. That's the big problem. Don't let anybody do your thinking for you. You know, we in this world today, it happens all the time. We allow somebody to think for us and we latch onto it. And rather than having our own genuine thoughts that are going through our head, you know, I don't care where you sit on the political realm. If you believe everything that party, you're allowing that whatever party you're for, if you allow them to think for you, you're a robot. You're a nobody. You're a foot soldier. You know, you're nothing more than these people who had to go work in the concentration camps. And I have intimate knowledge of the concentration camps because one of my grandfathers was there when they liberated them. And he was in charge of taking in the German soldiers because he could speak German. And this is the crazy thing. So this is something that I really want to talk about because it's manipulation of the media. We know Joseph Goebbels controlled all the media. So whatever was being pumped out to the Czechoslovakian households, to the Austrian households, and the German households was all controlled by Joseph Goebbels. So he got to speak the narrative. He did it with his own people. The German soldiers, the most common question my grandfather got coming in from the German soldiers was, what's New York City like now that it's bombed? We all know New York City was not bombed during World War II, but they had U-boat footage of it. So you sitting today in front of a television and CNN puts up a picture of of wherever, East Jamanabad. All right, and then they come up and say, we just bombed it. Well, you're going to have a likelihood to believe that because they have the pictures of it, the up close and personal pictures of it. Well, that's what Goebbels did. So I'm assuming that's the narrative they were able to spread wide throughout their people and their annexes, wherever they put their planted their castles. And I'm assuming they did that over there. But again, that moral compass that comes from here, like, you know what's right and what's wrong in your heart. Yeah.
At the ethics and the religion work in that, whether you're Muslim or Jewish or Christian, or
it all says do not kill,
and you can be an agnostic, you can be an atheist. There's just a sense of right and wrong, and there's I think Kant was the one that tried to boil it down to what are the things that are essential. Basically, don't make me a slave, and don't kill me. Those were to preserve your body and ultimately your mind, so that you could think critically. This whole notion of freedom and moving the ball forward, lying to. With the ability to save people's lives or their property was important.
He did that through financial means, correct?
Financial means. And we had one story. This is, sort of not in the book. But my dad was able to represent an individual, he told me this, where the child was disabled, and Hitler had not only race laws, but if you were a disabled person, you had mental issues, you were depressed, seriously depressed, you'd go into a camp, be exterminated. So he did save one of his clients' lives, who was a patient of Freud's office in Vienna. Sigmund Freud, that connects up so, a 19th century psychiatrist, psychologist, with my dad's law practice. It just brings it to life, these people that were scientific, and that because of the record that they had in Freud's office, that basically convinced the Nazis from not taking this young man to tyrosine. And the benefit was, when we came back to, we escaped, we came to the United States, this person was so appreciative, they emigrated to Canada. They sent my dad a $2,000 check that they still felt so the gratitude that they had to to just
imagine having that effect on somebody's life 60 years into the future, where they're still so grateful. $2,000 is a lot of money
in 1950 it was.
Oh, in 1950 did. Wow, that's a lot of money.
And this was a successful family.
That's a lot of money back then.
But it just, it's those kinds of things. Here, no good deed goes unpunished. This was a good deed that was rewarded.
I think the no good deed goes unpunished because I say it. I've
all
heard
the time,
it.
Yeah.
It's just you're looking at it from at the wrong time frame, because I don't think any good deed goes unpunished, or no deed goes punished. I just think the time frame that you're looking at it, if you do something nice and like the next day something happens, well, you're not looking further down the road, because stuff has a way of coming around. It's karmic. It's karmatic. So you write this book, The Quiet Hero, The Bridge to Freedom, and you brought a trailer. Mm-hmm. Hey, Andrew, can you play that trailer?
Set against the backdrop of unspeakable atrocities, hatred and war, one man dared to defy the darkness.
Go, go, go!
Discover the untold story of John Anton Drost, an extraordinary quiet hero. In the shadows of history, he stood tall, a beacon of hope amidst unspeakable atrocities. From humble beginnings, this unsung hero embarked on a transformative journey. Experience the triumphs and tribulations of a man whose commitment to justice knew no bounds. His tale will grip your heart, inspiring a renewed appreciation for the resilience of the human spirit. The Quiet Hero, a tale of valor, selflessness, and the unyielding strength of the human soul. Find it now, wherever books are sold.
That is riveting. It really is riveting. I think after watching that, I think that story has legs. I really, because it's a real story about humanity in a very difficult time. I love that word humanity because that's the best word I can describe about your father, John, because even though under difficult times, under threat of punishment, he did the right thing. And I don't think there's anybody out there that says he didn't.
Yeah, that trailer with the, and you see it quite a bit where Hitler is giving a speech and he's so animated and he's so forceful.
Best public speaker in history.
He's so charismatic. He frightens the living daylights out of his people. And even if you don't believe what he says, the force that he says it with frightens you. And it will make you compliant or complicit.
He had a way to mass hypnotize. So there's a technique used where you mimic somebody's behavior. And you can almost get them into a hypnotic state. There's some things that I'm not going to give out on the air because I don't want anybody getting hypnotized. Hitler had that. But do you understand that throughout all the footage of Hitler, throughout all the footage you see, you know there's only one piece of footage or one audio clip of him talking in his normal voice?
Or smiling a lot. I've seen him smile. But Nikki picks up on that years between World War I and World War II, when the kids are having their time for pranks and fun, about mesmerizing one of the girls. And that's the hypnotic spell. And that kind of goes into what you're talking about, is this ability to just captivate these audiences.
And you get them moving. So part of that is you do that crescendo of the way of speaking, and then you start moving your head and you'll see the audience start moving their head. Yeah. And that's
follow the pattern.
That's it. And then all of a sudden it's how you get sheep to go in the right direction.
And you get your torches and you get your singing and you get your common sort of bonding with everybody doing the same thing. And if you're out of step, you're out out of the party, out of the lifeline.
So your father must have enjoyed America more than, obviously, I want to believe, your father enjoyed America and the freedoms that are provided inside America more than people who were born here, because he knew the opposite, which is the whole concept of our show. It's you have to know the other side in order to truly appreciate the good stuff.
Yeah, and it doesn't take much punishment to appreciate the freedom that you have here. And to cherish it and to preserve it. And it doesn't take a long time to be under the thumb of an autocrat or a dictator or somebody that is going to take away your life, possibly your life, your property, constrict your life, and then come and have the ability to make decisions and not be punished for those decisions, whether they're talking about what's on your mind or what kind of a car you want to buy or what kind of neighborhood you can live in, what kind of job you can take, what church you can go to, what synagogue you can go to, what mosque you can go to, or not go. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that you understand that you have that decision of not to do something is part of also being free.
So there's a song by a guy named Dennis Leary. I think it's a Chicago guy.
Old Leary was the lady that burned the
town. Her cow knocked over the lantern. So there's a song and it's called "I'm an Asshole." Now, on surface value, the song seems like Dennis Leary was a comedian at the time, and it seems. But what it is it's a commentary on one's ability to do what they please, to a certain extent. And I wonder, if you can listen to that song and take out the funniness of it and the humor in it, it really is a commentary on, this is a guy that just wants to be himself, right? And I'm thankful that you wrote this book, because your father's legacy is going to be able to live on. Where do we find this book?
You can get it on Amazon. How about that? There's a trailer and then Barnes & Noble. So look it up under Quiet Hero, A Bridge to Freedom, and you'll pick it up. It will appear.
Jeff Bezos recommends it, obviously, if it's on Amazon.
He does, yeah. We couldn't get him to do a foreword or an endorsement, but I think he's okay with it.
Okay, great. That's great. George, I can't thank you enough for coming in, because we're coming to the end of this thing here. Now, obviously, in your father's words, what you know of your father, we end the show the same way every time. Suffering is a lesson. If you haven't learned a lesson from it, it's really a wasted opportunity. What do you think the suffering of freedom that your father really endured, what do you think it taught him?
The most obvious one is to really appreciate it, to revere it. And it came through the source, not just him, but it was people around him and our family. When we came here, we were sponsored by the Ravenswood Presbyterian Church. And this was, we came as displaced persons. We weren't refugees, technically, because we weren't going to go back. We were here to stay. And these people were so helpful and so kind that we were able to assimilate. But not everybody was kind, like my first grade teacher who told me I was stupid. And I was dumb because I couldn't write cursive on the right line on the blackboard. And I was held back from, or threatened to be held back from advancing into kindergarten 102. So, I actually didn't go to kindergarten. It was first grade of 102. But there were setbacks, and having parents that would speak with an accent, it was kind of strange. But Chicago, many people have accents. I mean, right now, if you try to contact us, a service center, everybody's got an accent.
Yes. I am grateful for your father, and that's John Anton Drost. I am grateful for him for this reason. Had it not been for your grandfather doing what he did, coming to this country and creating this life, and you coming to this country, I would never have met your daughter, who has been a great impact to me, been a great friend. And I've read pieces of this. Unfortunately, Julie didn't get it to me on time for me to read the whole thing, but what I did read, I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed the trailer, and I look forward to where this book is going to go.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of Freedom. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned. How bad does life have to be to smuggle a 3-year-old? You may be seen as a savior or a saint or a sinner. The equilibrium of life always finds a way. Live life by your moral code. But most importantly, thank God we are free. Appreciate it. And that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget to go to popple.com, get your digital business card, put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. Follow us on all social media. That's LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Clapper, TikTok, OnlyFans. And follow Mike at Mike_Felice. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. And we'll see you on the next episode.